Lands of Am, 104.4.
The first radio. It was a box with a cat's whiskers. Well, it's a little glass tube on top of the box, and to get the station, you had to twiddle a wire on this end here against a crystal in there, and that would change the station. But there was always a fight, because everybody wanted, there was only one set of earphones.
Never me again, go back on that underground train. Never me again, go back on that underground train. I took the train to Lancaster Gate, and the trouble that I met, I am going to relate. Well, friends, I had to call to a policeman when I lose my way in the tube station. So boys, I'm going to walk the journey and I'm bad a low, I'm bad a low labor. My first misery is when I embark at Piccadilly. I went down below, I stand up in the crowd, don't know where to go. I decided to follow a young lady. Well, I nearly met with my destiny. That night was bad luck for Kitchener. I fall down on the escalator. So boys, I'm going to walk the journey and the party. Hello!
You're listening to The Mike Show on Resonance FM with me, Jack Thurston. Now, as you probably know, in a couple of months, Londoners will go to the polls to elect a new mayor. And as we have previously discussed on The Mike Show, transport is one of the mayor's major responsibilities, and it's one of the hot issues in the mayoral election. So it's a great time to go for a ride with Christian Wolmar, a veteran journalist and Britain's leading transport commentator. Christian has written for pretty much every national newspaper in the UK, as well as writing books about the British railway system as well. He's also a London cyclist and a trustee of the London Cycling Campaign. I went to meet Christian where he lives in Tufnell Park.
I actually used to bicycle to school sometimes. I lived in off Kensington High Street and cycled in to South Ken in my sixth form years. It was only a mile and a half. And there was maybe a few years where I had a motorbike and a car. But then in my mid-20s, I started cycling regularly and have been doing ever since. And it's the way to get around.
And how have you noticed cycling changing in that time in London?
I think the amazing thing is that, say, 20 years ago or so, you'd cycle up to a traffic light and, you know, if you met another cyclist, you'd start chatting to them because it was such an unusual thing. And really, over the last, I suppose, over the last 10 years, it really has changed radically. And London has started to become something of a cycling city. And that's, you know, very exciting. It has changed completely from the days when, you know, I used to say hello to every cyclist.
Where are we going to ride today?
Well, we're just going to do my sort of standard run into town, which is fortunately mostly back streets and some bits of the old London cycling network. Pretty safe. So we're going from my house in Holloway, Tufnell Park, round the back. We don't get into Kentish Town, but sort of round the back of Kentish Town, past Camden School for Girls, down Camden Square, and then that wonderful route through Somers Town.
I'll follow you.
We're going up Carleton Road, and there's a flood. Oh, they're fixing it. It's been there for about 3 or 4 days, with water coming out of the road, and there's actually a JCB and a man trying to fix it, which is good.
Well, it still seems like it's gushing out, doesn't it?
It's certainly gushing out, and it's the second one over the space of a couple of weeks, actually. They do take ages to fix them, and of course they leave a lot of damage to the road, but hopefully they'll fix it. We're going up Carleton Road, which takes us to the top of a hill. I do live at the bottom of a hill, and it does take a couple of minutes to cycle up, but it's lovely at the end of the day because I get a nice downhill ride.
As someone who's been writing about transport and living in London, beyond cycling, what are the big structural challenges of getting people moving in our capital?
I think that is a big mistake, which is that to see the answer to transport as providing more and more facilities to enable people to get around more and more. Instead, I think you have to look at ways of restricting people and channeling people into the best forms of transport, public transport, walking, cycling. And that's really true of central London, where, you know, if you started building a city now, you'd obviously not build the streets in central London that you have. So clearly they are inappropriate for allowing cars in indiscriminately. And we really ought to have a strategy of beginning to limit cars coming into central London. And we had that with Ken Livingstone, started that idea.
Oh, we've got a street sweeper going along here. Did they give us the finger?
No, usually it's not half as busy along here. Anyway, so we had the idea of Ken Livingstone beginning to reduce the amount of traffic through the congestion charge, which was not really a way of raising money. It was a way of trying to transform the environment of central London. But unfortunately, that impetus has been lost. You know, we ought to be squeezing the car more and more out of central London. And the Westminster car parking charge issue, even though I don't trust Westminster's motives, was the right sort of thing to do.
Well, that's where they were saying we're going to be a lot more strict on car parking.
And a lot more expensive to park your cars even at night.
You mentioned the old London street pattern, which was really set down in the era of the horse.
Yes.
And Britain was the first country to industrialise, first country to get railways everywhere. Do you think that we pay a penalty for having been an early adopter of all these transportation technologies, that we're saddled with the first draft of essentially a flawed way of putting things down?
No, I'm delighted that we have that. I mean, if you think about it, the alternative would be designing a city on the American grid system, and that's simply awful. You know, it hasn't been designed around the car. As that is the case, then we should clearly not allow cars to be using that limited space indiscriminately. I mean, it's a completely insane idea, to let cars into this space when, you know, there isn't the provision for them, and to have, you know, what is the Stalinist method of control, which is by queuing rather than making people pay for this scarce resource. Whoa!
Well, we had a Audi that almost took us out as she was coming round that corner a little fast.
God, she really was. We've had many more incidents than I normally have on this, inevitably. Normally, this route down to into town, which I use nearly every day, is much quieter.
A lot of people say, well, if we had the public transport that they've got over there, if we had this or that, then I would give up my car happily. Do you think people are... Do you think that's just a way of making a choice to use the car seem a more acceptable thing to do? Or do you think people genuinely believe that?
Oh, no, absolutely. We have a fantastic public transport system. You know, of course, you know, it is crowded sometimes. Of course, it's inadequate at times. But, you know, since Livingstone improved the buses, which he did enormously, and Boris, to his credit, has kept that up. You know, we have a very good... We're going left there. We have a very good public transport system, including the buses. And, yes, you know, it is relatively expensive and it should be cheaper. But nevertheless, You know, anybody who uses their car as their main way of getting around central London is just bonkers. You know, or, and you know, it's not right that people don't use it because they're inadequate public transport system. That might be true outside London, but not inside London.
Can you identify a historical moment when the car really took charge of the streets of London?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that it was in the late 50s, early 60s, when the London Underground had been greatly neglected. Mass car ownership was really coming to the fore. And you had these fantastic traffic jams, which I remember going to school sometimes when I wasn't cycling to school. My father would take us to school, and sometimes, you know, it was almost quicker to walk. You know, it was absolute chocker with traffic. And I think that was the low point of public transport and the high point of the car. And then we got, you know, meter maids, as they were called, beginning to control parking in central London. And there was outrage about that. And again, it shows just the fact that whenever you get people beginning to restrict movements of the car, there's always mass protest. But nobody would seriously think that you could now have free parking in the centre of London. In fact, I think that's happened in Aberystwyth. It happened where, for some administrative reason, the traffic wardens were not allowed to issue tickets, and they've had a free-for-all. And, of course, that's created complete chaos. And similarly, you know, I remember, you know, them pedestrianising Leicester Square. And, you know, it took something like 30 years to pedestrianise the whole of Leicester Square. They did one side and then another side. And the notion now that you'd say, oh, let's bring back cars to Leicester Square because, you know, it's a real drag, you can't drive up there, is completely insane. But the logic of that has not been understood. The logic has not been that, hey, every time we restrict cars, yes, there's a bit of chaos initially, but then people's behaviour adapts. And what's more, the environment improves. I mean, nobody would seriously say, let's bring back cars to Carnaby Street.
Oh, we're just being passed by a tipper truck here.
I must emphasise, this route is generally, you know, quite a peaceful route in. Today it's been absolute chaotic. Maybe it's because it's 9:30 in the morning, but I don't normally have this amount of risk on my little route in.
Why do you think we haven't done that learning, and why does the car lobby retain its potency in opposing these incremental improvements that every time one happens it seems to make things better? Why do we not learn? Why do we have this amnesia?
I think it's a mixture of laziness and vested interests. I think the laziness is just that people like the idea of just getting in their car you know, in the morning and thinking that they're going to get a blissful ride in, and in fact, you know, generally it's chaos, but they can listen to the radio, it's warm in the winter and it's cool in the summer. So that's laziness. But then there's the vested interest, and I think one, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I think you do have to look at the way that the car lobby, the motoring lobby, is so strong, you know, which has the manufacturers and all the other people associated with the industry behind it. And, you know, cycling and walking don't generate much money, do they? It's a cheap, easy way of getting around. It doesn't really fit into the capitalist model very well. I mean, look at China, where until they embraced their kind of state capitalism, everybody cycled, and now everybody gets stuck in traffic jams.
So let's take the story forward to the point at which London started electing its mayor, whose principal responsibility, I guess, aside from the police force, is transport. Do you think that marked a change, regardless of the people who are elected for that job? Do you think having an elected mayor who has a transport brief changed things?
Yes, I think it's very important that we have an elected mayor and with a strong transport brief. Oddly enough, it's about the only election that I know of where transport really is kind of up there amongst the top couple of issues. I mean, most elections, particularly general elections, transport doesn't get a look in. Even rail privatisation in the 1992 election was barely mentioned, you know, and you know, it's always the economy and the health service and sometimes even foreign affairs, but never transport. So I think that's important. I think the fact that, you know, we do have a healthy investment programme on transport, you know, which is endorsed by both main political parties, I think is certainly partly down to the fact that we now have an elected mayor, you know, with transport as their main brief.
And if we look at the record of the two mayors that we've had, how would you help Londoners make their transportation choice when it comes to the next mayor?
I think it's disappointing, actually, that even though transport is a central part of their brief, I don't think either of them really gets it. I mean, they get it in terms of saying, well, you know, we need Crossrail, and that's fine, and we need to, you know, to spend more. But I don't think they really get it in terms of having a big modal shift towards cycling and walking in the way that Copenhagen has, Amsterdam has, all sorts of smaller northern European towns. I really began to look at it and say, well, you know, it's unsustainable that we have this private car emphasis. What they've done in towns like that is to define a central area and begin to squeeze the car out of the central area. Nobody is suggesting that, you know, if you're going to go from, say, you know, Croydon to Leighton, you know, that it's going to be easy to do it by any other means, by a car. But there's an awful lot of journeys in central London that where you could squeeze out the car and you could create a completely different environment. And I think that's the key point. And neither Boris nor Ken, I don't know why we always call them by their first names, but anyway, Livingston or Johnson, has really articulated, you know, a wider, exciting vision of changing London and using the transport system to do that.
I got the impression from the Ken Livingston mayoralty, the two terms that he had, that he was very much focusing new development, new buildings around transportation hubs. So they would happen at Waterloo, where there was a big station, they would happen at London Bridge, where we've got the Shard in the city. So that the idea would being that people would come in on a train if they were coming from where they live in the outer boroughs and not have to make a second journey by taxi, by bus, and that would make things work better. Is that a reasonable approximation of his vision for a broader spatial development of the city, that it was very much focused on those transport nodes?
Certainly I have no problem with the idea of making the centre of London high density, whether it's high density of jobs or high density of accommodation. I think that's a great idea, but that's not all that you have to do. I think that the problem with Ken Livingstone's idea was that, you know, it kind of stopped there. He didn't really begin to think of you know, transforming central London. He did have more ideas than Boris. He was going to change Parliament Square, and he did change Trafalgar Square, and look what a difference that has made. But we need to do that 10 times over. You know, we changed Shoreditch by getting rid of the one-way system. But hey, I live on a one-way system in Camden Road, Holloway, Parkhurst Road, all that, Seven Sisters, that goes all the way to Finsbury Park, you know, about, you know, 3 or 4 miles of a one-way system. God, it would be better if we got rid of that. And yes, there might be a small cost in extra journey times, but, you know, it would make a radical change to the way we live. So he's thought about it a little bit, but he hasn't then kind of gone on to make that the central thrust of his policies. It's still about, oh, you know, spending lots of money on big infrastructure projects, which is not the answer.
And looking at Boris, you know, he does ride a bike. He introduced the cycle hire scheme and would like to be regarded as the bicycling bicyclist's mayor.
Oddly enough, I think neither Johnson or Livingston get cycling. You know, Livingstone doesn't use a bike and uses public transport, and he did put some money into the London Cycling Network scheme, but he didn't really kind of get it. And Johnson just thinks that everybody can cycle around like him, you know, being a confident alpha male. You know, if I can go round Elephant and Castle, why can't everybody? Seems to be his strategy, and he doesn't really understand that to really make this big shift in cycling, he has to ensure that people feel safe. And to do that requires devoting a lot more space to cycling, restricting traffic to 20 miles an hour on nearly all roads, making it in many ways much more cycle friendly, and that he hasn't understood. So he thinks, oh, you know, the cycle hire scheme will change this. And yes, I mean, it's been a good idea, the cycle hire scheme, but it's been an awful lot of money, and I'm not exactly sure what it does in transport terms. You know, it will encourage some people to cycle and then go and buy their own bikes, but I'm not sure it's a real game changer that he thinks it is.
Right, well, here we are.
This is one of the rare bits of cycling infrastructure in London, which is, you know, actually a bit of specially dedicated two-lane cycle path alongside St Pancras Way, which is one way for cars, segregated and safe. And, you know, this takes you all the way down. We're going to turn right here. This takes you all the way down to Somers Town. So it's about, you know, 3/4 of a mile of dedicated cycle path which Camden has put in. It has some issues, like, for example, you have to be wary of traffic that comes in from the right. And certainly when they first installed it along Royal College Street, there was some problems with drivers coming in and not realising that there was cyclists effectively going on the contraflow. But I've used this a lot subsequently, and actually it works pretty well now, and for the most part the cars have now learnt that you know, there are cyclists.
There is this debate about how do we shift the modal share of cycling upwards from 2%. Do we do it by providing the kind of cycle track that we're on here, segregated and protected, or do we do it by making it easier for cyclists to mix with all the other traffic on the roads?
Look, I think this is a terribly sterile debate that cycling activists tend to get into and really distracts from the issue. Look, I think it's a horses for courses issue. I think, of course, wherever possible, if you can put in lovely two-lane cycle track like here, you do it. And you take away space from cars, and it's quite simple to do. But there's a lot of places you can't do that, or you can only do that at disproportionate cost, where it really isn't worthwhile in terms of either the cost or the number of cyclists that you might get. So, you know, then you do something else. But I think the key point is that you keep cycling in mind whatever scheme you're designing. And I think Transport for London, after the terrible deaths there have been recently, and the fact that cycle safety is going up the agenda, partly thanks to the Times campaign, and, you know, partly, you know, because we're coming up to an election, you know, I think that Transport for London is beginning to get that with its junctions review and so on. But it's clear that, you know, the way they do it in Northern Europe is by having cyclists at the heart of the issue, you know, and not as an afterthought. And whether it's segregated or whether it's, you know, a kind of lane next to the road and so on, I think in the end is a matter of, you know, what the particular design. Even in Holland, you get places where, you know, you have cycle lanes that aren't particularly wonderful because it just, you know, it has not been proved possible to design the perfect facility. So I think this is a real issue where perfection is the enemy of the good. And, you know, I'm really bored by these, you know, fundamental arguments about whether you have this sort of facility or, you know, some cyclists are even against segregated facilities because they think, oh, that's a bad idea. Well, since we're never going to have segregated facilities anywhere, everywhere, you know, people, you know, might as well at least benefit from them wherever they can, rather than this idea that since we're not going to have them everywhere, we shouldn't have them at all. Because then people will get used to them and won't be able to cycle on normal roads. I think that's just a mistaken view.
We've talked about the politicians. Let's talk about the bureaucrats and the technocrats who are responsible for making our streets the way they are. Do you think that they are capable of producing city streets that are fit for cycling, and it's just that the fact that the politicians don't tell them to do that? Or do you think that there is a culture in transport planning in this country that is really not with it when it comes to cycling?
Now, look, there's certainly some highway engineers who are not with it, but the issue here remains with the politicians. That's absolutely clear. It's absolutely clear from dealings with Transport for London and dealings with local authorities in my past capacity as a member of the board of the sadly demised Cycling England. There's no doubt that if the political will was there, it just happened. Now, some of that is, sheer antipathy towards cycling from some kind of particular politicians. Some of it is concern about costs, and some of it, I think, is the fact that cyclists are not perceived as a particularly, important lobby. And that's changing. That's clearly, the Times campaign. The fact that the Times ran on the front page, 3 days running kind of cycling issues, shows that actually, I think the climate is changing. Here we are at the British Library, where there's lots of cycling parking, and generally it's a fairly safe run down, but it wasn't this morning. There was dumper trucks trying to, woman in an Audi going around a corner far too fast, and so on. But generally it's more pleasant than that. But anyway.
So we're here. We're at our journey's end today, but cycling in Britain and the development of cycling is by no means at its journey's end. We are still, in my view, in the period of the great extinction of cycling, which I would say began at that time when you mentioned, when there was the rise of the motor car in the late 50s, 60s, and a lot more people had cars and decided that it was their natural birthright as a British citizen to use them wherever they wanted without fee or hindrance. You've given some policy prescriptions for making Britain a better place to ride a bike, and London in particular. They're not rocket science, are they, really? We're not doing anything new that hasn't been done anywhere else in the world or somewhere else in the world.
No, but I think the key point is this. The key point is that we need to get the politicians beginning to celebrate cycling. We actually got that this week, amazing enough. Parliamentary debate and the fact that cycle safety has gone up the agenda. But that's cycle safety. We need more than that. We need the fact to celebrate the fact that cycling is just a fantastic win-win situation for everybody. It's good for the environment. It's good for you personally. It's good for the feel of the city. It's a quiet way to get around. It's a fast way to get around. I get around central London far faster than by any other means. It's absolutely has virtually no downsides. And it's almost as if we haven't discussed this before. As if people want to create a downside by saying, oh, cyclists go through red lights, and cyclists misbehave and so on, which is clearly a nonsensical issue because, A, cyclists very, very, very rarely hit pedestrians, and if they do, they're not likely to kill them, whereas, 700-800 people a year are killed by cars. But also that, car drivers disobey the law all the time. And nobody else says, oh, we shouldn't have cars because they disobey the law. Car drivers go beyond 30 miles an hour in town the whole time. They go through red lights. They go on advanced stop lines. They go, on turn around corners crazily, as the lady in the Audi we just met did, We have to stop being defensive about this. We need politicians to say, hey, this is a fantastic means of transport. Let's support it. Let's throw lots of money behind it. But above all, let's throw our political support behind it.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you about this mayoral election. How is it going to play out, do you think? How do you see the campaign going? Who should win and who's going to win?
Well, I think that, I mean, I had thought for a long time that Johnson would stay ahead, because people don't really see through his bluster, and you know, he manages to make a joke of things, and it certainly works, especially in outer London. But Livingstone is coming up on the rails here, and I think the fares issue has hit home. I don't entirely trust the idea that Livingstone is going to manage to deal with affairs in the way that he's promised to, with reductions and not putting them up and so on. But nevertheless, it's a promise that Londoners like, and it's going to be very close. And I'll stick my neck out and say that Johnson will win it 51-49, but it will be a very close contest.
And who ought to win?
Well, you know, I'm an old lefty, and so even though I have real problems with Livingstone, you know, I'd much prefer that he would win. I think ultimately he would do a lot more for cycling too. You know, I think that despite the fact he's not a cyclist, I think he'd have the right people around him, whereas, you know, Johnson, certainly with Calvia Ranger, didn't. With Isabel Dedring, she certainly does understand cycling, and if he kept her as advisor, it you know, it might be better for cycling than otherwise. But Livingstone will undoubtedly do more for cycling than Johnson.
I was riding with Christian Walmart, and you can find out more about his thoughts on transport at his website, www.christianwalmar.co.uk. And he's also on Twitter, at Christian Walmar. If you're interested in what the London election means for cyclists, then do check out Londoners on Bikes, a non-party political campaign to make cycling the central issue in the upcoming election. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.